Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. In the opening scene of the new movie, The Hate U Give, an African-American father gives his three children the talk over the dinner table. If they are pulled over, the father says, they should put their hands on the dashboard where the officer can see them, answer his questions, and despite all they might go through, they should remember that being black is something to be proud of. The lead character is the teenager Star Carter, two R's in Star, who witnesses a police officer shoot and kill her unarmed best friend during a traffic stop, a scene that recalls all too vividly real-life stories that dot the nation. This hour on Point, The Hate U Give, The Lessons We Learn, and the Aspirations and Challenges Shared by African-American Youths. We're going to speak to some young activists later this hour. But first, joining me now here in studio in New York is George Tillman Jr. He's a film director, producer, and screenwriter known for his films Soul Food, Barbershop, Men of Honor, and Notorious, among others. He is the director of The Hate U Give, which is set for wide release today. George, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the release of your film.
Oh, thank you. I'm very excited.
That talk that Maverick gives felt really personal. I want listeners to hear that because they haven't had a chance to see the movie yet. Mm-hmm. In the opening scene of the movie, Star's father, Maverick Carter, gives the talk to his three kids. They are ages 10, 9, and 1.
Now, when it happens, don't act mad. You got to look calm. Answer their questions, but don't tell them nothing extra. Keep your hands out your pockets. You drop something, leave that where it's at.
Maverick.
Leave that stuff where it's at. My bad.
That talk in the movie felt incredibly intimate and personal to me on viewing. How close was that to a talk that you either received or given?
Yeah, you know, that's something that I experienced very young. That came from various family members. My father, at a very young age, I remember around at least about 11, 10 years old, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's where I grew up as a young kid. It was the ideal of really trying to make me aware of the issues that they came through, you know, living in Milwaukee through the MLK riots and Detroit as well. It's just the ideal of how do you survive? How do you know how to act and how to conduct yourself around a police officer? For me, it was always about the ideal of being in cars, you know, having the music down, especially when I turned 16. That talk came back up for me because I was learning how to drive, you know. Music always down, always looking the cop straight in the face, always being very calm, keeping your hands where they can be able to see it. But this is an everyday occurrence in the community, and especially in the African-American community, where most people are dealing with the birds and the bees, we're having a talk and learning how to conduct ourselves around a police officer.
You've made this movie based on the best-selling book, the novel, by, I believe it's Angie Thomas, stratospheric seller. Pitched at young adults, but it seems as though it speaks to grown-ups as well. What spoke to you about this book? Why do you want to make this into a movie?
I think, you know, obviously the book was very relevant and very present in what we're dealing with today. For me, it was identification, identifying who you really are. The ideal of Star, this young 16-year-old girl, having to code switch, which is living in the inner city community that she lives in, being one way. And then when she's in her white private school, she had to act another. It's almost her personality changed, her way she talked, and everything changed just to compromise herself to make other people feel better. I thought that was something that was completely original. I'd never seen in the film, and I felt like many people cannot be able to identify with that.
Her aspirations, particularly driven by her mother, to sort of get out of the community that she's in, and the idea that maybe they want to set their sights outside, but there's that tension.
Yeah, there's definitely a tension. I remember when I was young, my parents moved me to a white public school that was 70%, 80% white compared to the African-American public school I went to. And sometimes then within parents, there could be a difference of who stays and who leaves. You know, Russell Hornsby, who plays Mav, wants to stay in the community. Regina Hall, who plays Lisa in the film, wants to be able to move out and see her kids and see other things. So it was this constant battle of staying and not going. But these two people still love each other. They're still loving parents. And we see the loving relationship in this strong family throughout all these obstacles. That's what I'm mostly proud of about in the film the most.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is obviously it's hitting on a lot of issues that are relevant right now. The question of the way in which law enforcement officers deal with young African-Americans, particularly African-American men. There's also points in the film and in the story in which Star, you know, is very clear-eyed about the role of drug dealers and the role of, you know, the sale of drugs in and around her family and her community. And she really clearly wants no part of that as well. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the decision to highlight that and to separate apart from that even as she's struggling with the question of law enforcement as well.
Yeah. You know, in the ideal of Star with these two worlds that she's navigating, all that is getting compromise, and she's getting backed up to the wall where she witnessed the shooting of her childhood friend Khalil. And because of this shooting, she becomes the witness. So within her being the witness, she starts to question everything around her. And I thought that was very, very important to how we question, you know, why do a police officer, you know, shoot first, ask questions later. And a lot of that came to the ideal of the system, and a lot of that became an ideal of the skin color. We see that when we see Common as well, playing the police officer, Carlos. It becomes a systematic issue, you know, what is being taught, how we perceive one another. Star, now because of the shooting, being the witness, she recognized all these issues and how her relationship with her white friends at school. So all these things for the movie for me was just to bring this, all these up, to be able to recognize, to be able to see things, and also be able to, how do we move forward in our relationships with one another.
You know, Tupac Shakur kind of hovers in some ways, it seems to me, over the spiritual godfather of this movie. Maybe I'm getting that wrong, but it seemed to me as the very title of the movie itself, taken from his admonition about what the hate that kids learn does to them.
Yep.
Yet, you know, he was talking a generation ago about things that had been enduring for generations to African-Americans of this country. How hopeful are you that the moment we're in now, the recognition, the question of Black Lives Matter, but also public officials and others taking up this question, that there can be some progress, that there can be some understanding that while law enforcement officers face dangerous jobs, it is true, and deal with some difficult challenges, at the same time, you know, the way in which they treat African Americans can often have very dire, dire consequences.
Yeah, you know, I think this is the, you know, this movie can sort of, you know, what we wanted to do was be able to show some of the issues, be able to show where this is coming from and how do we be able to move forward. And I really think it really starts with our young people. You know, that's why I'm so happy that Star at 16, if you look at a lot of the movements that is happening with the Black Lives Matter, a lot of these are young individuals. You look at the Black Panthers that Mav quotes, you know, throughout the whole film, the 10-step program that the Black Panthers take on. These were people that were in their young 20s. So the ideal is, as young people, we can, you know, how do we make change? By looking at the system and wanting change first. And the most important thing is about listening. We need to listen to one another.
Well, it was interesting because in that very early scene, Star's dad, Maverick, alludes to the Black Panthers. And initially, I thought there was a little bit of a comedic effect there. I mean, his wife, her mom, kind of rolls her eyes and says, oh, goodness, are we really going to go into this?
Yeah.
You know, and yet it seemed as though that was saying, well, there's some wisdom here. I mean, Black Panthers, obviously, for those not as familiar, were radicals in the day and advocated not the most peaceful means of change at all. But there were some principles there that you're talking about responsibility that he was trying to articulate.
Yeah, responsibility and ancestors, knowing where we come from, and the ideal of looking at us as African Americans, poor people, people at the bottom, how do we be able to stop police brutality? You know, the Black Panthers were way ahead of the game. You know, it's like 52 years later, and the same issues that they talk about 52 years ago, we're still dealing with today. And one of the great lines that I really love, that what Mav says in there to his young daughter at a very early age, he says, "We come from greatness. We come from great people. I didn't name you Star for nothing." And that's what Star learns throughout the movie, is she's shining her light, not only for herself, but informing all those around her and letting them see a different light and letting them see different things about race and about how we treat one another.
We're going to be talking shortly to some young African-American activists around the country in just a few minutes on this program. What are your aspirations for this film and what it can do for both their conversation understanding, but also that for the greater society?
I think more importantly, we really wanted people to look at the film and take something away from it, from themselves. You know, Star deals with race relationship in terms of how she deals with her other counterparts at her white private school, things that they may say that may be disrespectful outside of inside our culture they may not be aware of. Or, you know, so she has a white boyfriend in terms of Chris. And how he sees things. The one of the main things he says, he don't see color. She tells you have to see color. I'm African American. Our experience is completely different. Mm-hmm. But we look at all these things and the police brutality, and we look at finding your voice. We start finding her voice, and bias that we may have within ourselves. All these things are in the movie, and it's done in a way where Star is our leading narrative. Taking something away from this movie and be able to enlighten, be able to inspire, and also more importantly to have empathy instead of sympathy. I think that's the most important thing in us moving forward, that you can take something away or be a conversation starter.
The listening. Question of listening right now. How well do we listen right now as a country?
I think we have a hard time listening. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to voice opinion. Social media is definitely leading the way. That's what I love about making films is a community. You have to sit in the theater with people who are different than you, who sit next to you, and you enjoy this experience together. That's the power of going to the theater, and that's what I feel that we need to do collectively as America, as a group of people, is be able to listen and be able to acknowledge and respect each other.
In the brief time we have left, a lot of heartbreak in this film, and yet do you feel hope coming out of it?
Yeah, that's what I love. When we see it with audience, it's just unbelievable. Like, there's emotion, there's laughter, there's a lot of humor in here, you know, in terms of Star and her relationship around her. And then the most important thing is being inspired. I love how audiences, like, they stand up and they clap at the end of this movie. And that's really what I want this movie to do. And I hope, you know, I want people to go out and be able to see it and support it.
You've been hearing the voice of the director, George Tillman. He's led The Hate U Give, a very rending and moving movie that's out today. George Tillman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're discussing today what it means to be black in America and the release of this new movie, The Hate U Give. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the movie? Are you lined up to get tickets? What themes resonate with you? What interests you about it? What themes resonate within your families and your communities? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking to young activists about the new film, The Hate U Give, out for wide release today, and also what it means to be a young African American in America today. We want you to join in. What aspects of the Carter family story resonate in your own life, in your own community? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We just heard from George Tillman Jr. He's the director of the movie. He told us about the importance of listening, and he also said to us, it starts with young people. Well, we get to hear from a panel of three young activists from across the country right now. First, joining me from Chicago is Alicia Moten, a 17-year-old senior at Kenwood Academy. She's a member and organizer with Good Kids Mad City, an advocacy organization that includes young people from Baltimore and Chicago who are working to end violence in their cities. Alicia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
And joining us from New York is Demetrius Doward. He's a 17-year-old senior at Washington Heights Expeditionary Learning School, a member of Million Hoodies Movement for Justice. That's an organization that trains leaders to fight against and end anti-black racism and systemic violence. Demetrius, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us from Franklin, Wisconsin is Kaya Hines. She's a 16-year-old junior at Franklin High School just outside Milwaukee. She's a program coordinator at Leaders Igniting Transformation Milwaukee, a nonprofit organization led by youth of color that organizes young people around issues related to political power and social, racial, and economic justice. Kaya, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Kaya, first, let's start with you. George Tillman is from Milwaukee himself. What struck you about our conversation today?
I think one of the biggest things that struck me was him talking about star code switching. Mm-hmm. And I find that often for me because I do live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but I go to a white suburban school out here in Franklin, Wisconsin.
So can we just take a moment, and I'd like to unpack that a bit. For those folks who might not know about it, code switching is basically, as I understand it, you know, basically switching how you talk and how you handle yourself if you're in different communities, different neighborhoods. How does it play out for you?
Well, so I always went to NPS, or not NPS, but just school in Milwaukee because that's where I live. Mm-hmm. But when I started as a freshman in high school, I came over to Franklin High School, and it was a whole new ball game for me going from being around people all day who looked and talked just like me, now coming here to people who look completely different than me and have different lingo and different slang than I have. So I remember my freshman year, I would still talk like normal or I would still use certain slang, and people would not understand what I meant by saying certain words, or I would just feel different for talking less proper than they did. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just started to teach myself that when I'm at school, I talk proper, I use proper English, and when I go home, I'm able to talk how I feel comfortable talking and use the slang that my family and friends are used to.
You know, there's a scene in the movie that speaks directly to that. Star Carter is played by the actor Amanda Sternberg. She lives two lives. She's shuttling between Garden Heights, her poor and mostly black neighborhood, and Williamson, which is an affluent, mostly white private prep school that she attends. In this scene, as Star enters Williamson, she explains that she also shuttles between two different personas.
Garden Heights is one world. Williamson is another. And I gotta keep it separate. So when I'm here, I'm Star version two. That means flipping a switch in my brain. Williamson Star doesn't use slang. If a rapper would say it, she doesn't, even if her white friends do.
Hey, boo.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, bro.
Slang makes them cool. Slang makes me hood.
Yo, those kicks are lit.
Thanks, Space Jams.
Kay, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that is exactly what I'm referring to.
I wonder, Alicia, you know, you read the book as well, if I'm not mistaken. Are these themes that kind of play out in your own life where you have to think about how you handle yourself because of the fact that you're African-American?
Yeah, specifically to like my own past experiences, mm-hmm. I used to live in a suburb when I was younger. And so the transition from when I moved away to the city and how everybody speaks and how you had to act is like completely different. And so because of like the areas of where I work at, I definitely have to experience the idea of code switching because it's like because you are black, saying these words and acting like this makes you appear as hood or makes you appear as less educated than somebody else. So when you're around these people, even though we don't like intentionally mean to do it, it just kind of happens subconsciously because you never want to be like labeled as something like that. And so I resonate with Star a lot because when I had to switch back and forth between both of my mostly white communities and mostly populated with black communities, the way I spoke, the way I talked, the way I dressed, the way I acted was completely different. So I definitely can relate to the idea of code switching.
Alicia, how much of an extra burden is that walking around having to think consciously about how you present yourself? Or is that kind of similar to, you know, how teenagers have to figure out who they're going to be anyway?
I think it's definitely an extra burden that we have because for black people, it's this idea of a double identity that we always have
but
to face.
Demetrius, you wanted to weigh in there for a sec?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead. Forgive me, Alicia. Go right ahead.
Sorry.
Live radio, folks.
I definitely think that it's way more harder for a black person to find themselves because we're always faced with having to fight so many negative stereotypes that's already approaching us in the first place. So I think if you're somebody who doesn't grow up being educated on history of our people and learning about how to really truly love yourself for being black, and you're kind of just growing up in a world where if you're not hearing these things, but you're hearing black people are uneducated, they're this, they're that, they're hood, they'll never learn, blah, 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 blah. It's kind of like, so what do I have to conform myself to seem like I can make it? So I think code switching is definitely a burden for a lot of Black people, because especially a lot of young Black people, because we're not fully aware of ourselves yet. And so when we're faced on trying to be ourselves, but then also faced on trying to please others, it does become an extra burden, because most other people won't have to go through that because they're already the ideal of perfection in other people's eyes, but we aren't.
Demetrius, do you have a different take on that?
I agree on that. That when I'm in certain situations, like when I have like a job interview or something, I will put on a voice, like not to be like, I'll put on like a white voice, if that's correct. But you get back to me on that.
Sure, of course. I actually, what I did want to ask you about a little bit was, you know, we heard from Maverick, who's the father of Star Carter, in that opening scene, about how important it was to be proud of being Black. And at the same time, he offered that in the context of the talk about how young Black kids, boys and girls, needed to handle themselves when they were dealing with law enforcement officials. Demetrius, did you ever receive a version of the talk like that?
Yes, I received a talk like that when I was younger.
So how'd that play out? What was that like?
It was this one night when me and my father, we was like in the kitchen talking, and we were just talking about driving and stuff, and we got to the topic about police when we get pulled over. And we were talking about like when the cops pull over, like he always put his hands on the steering wheel, and he told me when I get older and like getting licensed to do that. And like a few months back, that happened. Like the cops pulled us over, and my father put his hands on the steering wheel, so I put my hands on dashboard too. I was like kind of nervous because like the videos I've been seeing lately on social media about like the police brutality and like how graphic it can get.
Alicia, you know, in Chicago, obviously, there's a trial of the police officer who shot Laquan McDonald. He was found guilty. That doesn't always happen. A police officer goes on trial for the shooting of one of Star Carter's friends in the movie The Hate U Give, and I'm not going to give away a plot point by saying how that plays out. But at the same time, you know, that was a big deal for what happened in Chicago. How was received, you know, among your family and friends?
It was received very positively. Ever since the entire thing happened with Laquan, so many Chicago activists and organizations have been doing so much work for Laquan's family, for those who are affected by police brutality. And when we found out that Jason Van Dyke was going on trial and that everything was happening, we were just so scared that it was going to happen again, that another police officer was going to get away with killing a young Black teenager. And we were just so worried that when we were all watching it, we were just, like, silent. I remember watching it on the phone with my friend, and we were, like, we could barely breathe because we were just so nervous that he was going to be found not guilty. And so when he was found guilty, we did action downtown. We protest, like, just, like, in celebration of this is what actually getting justice feels like. And so many organizations, like Good Kids, Mad City, the one that I'm in, Asada's Daughters, No Cop Academy, like, so many of us have been doing so much work to fight against police brutality and fight for police accountability of those police officers who are literally killer cops and are still in the field and don't, and they just pretty much get off with it. So when Jason Van Dyke was convicted, it was just, like, kind of like, this is what justice feels like. And we worked so hard for this and to make national coverage for it and to not let just be like, this is happening in Chicago, that's it. And so for it to just be a known thing with everybody and for everyone to just send love to Chicago, it was such like a beautiful day for so many people who have done work for this.
You know, it seemed like an extraordinary moment, obviously. The videotape taken on smartphones making a big difference there in shootings in North Charleston, South Carolina, and other places. And at the same time, obviously, you got to rally attention. How was your organization playing into that? What did you guys do as teenagers to try to take part in what you felt was a constructive and civil way?
So just to give like a good like quick like synopsis on what Good Kids, Mad City is.
Sure.
So pretty much we're a youth-led organization that is for police accountability. We like to reiterate the idea of what communities mostly populated with Black and brown youth can be safe without the idea of an overpopulized presence of police. And so we're here to heal youth and to give trauma reform and so many like beautiful things to give back to communities that are taken away from. So Good Kids, Mad City, we've been like We get in touch with families who have been affected by gun violence. We've paid for funeral things for teens who have lost their lives to this. And so we have just been really hands-on with a lot of youth and a lot of family who have lost loved ones to gun violence. And we have done, like, City Hall sit-downs where we've been in City Hall from 9 to 5 to just pretty much, like, show, like, the people in office that, like, you can't shut youth's voice down. Like, we're here and we're here to make a change in our city. And so just we've been really working to fight for causes like this, to fight for police accountability and just this idea of putting attention to gun violence in Chicago and how it's not just a Chicago issue. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's one of the main reasons why we came to be an organization, was to really highlight the point of Black kids getting shot in Chicago isn't like a, oh, this is y'all problem. It's a problem that's happening, like, everywhere. Police brutality, that's something that's happening everywhere. Young kids dying, that's not just a, oh, it's whatever. This should be just as national as any other thing that happens. And so that's what we're really working for.
I'd like to take a couple of calls. We've got a lot of interest from our listeners on this. Janice is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Janice, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, David. Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting conversation. I want to say that I think that this is a three-pronged, three-dimensional problem. You have police brutality, which is real. You have an economic piece, and you also have a mental health piece that is not being addressed in our communities. Because of the economic piece, many people are in the mode of survival. And because of racism, we have that built in our society. So you have that issue that needs to be dealt with. But the mental health piece of it really needs to be addressed, talked about at the high school level, at the college level, in churches. You cannot pray your way out of maladaptive coping skills. And a lot of our people do not have the proper coping skills to be able to live peacefully, even in their inner city communities. Violence is a symptom of a very, very deep, deep problem. And if we just address it, I like movies, but we cannot address it through movies. We have to start talking about our mental health. And this is going to make will help it a lot. And also, we need to make mental health services available. The fact that many health insurances do not provide a piece for mental health is a huge problem in this country. If you have medical insurance, if you have some type of state medical insurance, mental health counseling and therapy ought to be a part of that.
Sure.
Until we address that, we are not going to stop killing each other. We are not going to stop seeing all of the little things, all of the big things that are happening within our society that let us know that we are not well as a people.
Janice,
okay, I'll just listen off the air.
No, I appreciate that your call. I appreciate your perspective on that, and I assure you that's an issue that we'll take seriously and continue to cover here at On Point. I'd also like to take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Victoria, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a white mom married to a white husband. We have two white kiddos, and we have adopted four Black kids. And it's so interesting to see the changes that have happened. They've been home for like 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost a battle to fight with them, to help them maintain their identity as Black. One of them is mixed Black and Hispanic. And she didn't even know that she was Hispanic before she came home at 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they never connected to their own racial identity before they came into an all-white family. And so trying to help them connect with that now.
Let me throw that to our young experts here. Victoria, thank you so much for your call. You're sharing your experience. We only have a couple minutes before we take a brief break. But Kaya Hines, why don't you, if you're willing to take offer a little thoughts on that, how would you suggest she try to help her young children maintain their African-American identity?
I think a big piece of maintaining your African-American identity is understanding that it's deeper than just being American, because I know a lot of people who don't like the term African-American because they feel like they just want to be called Black because they don't know their African background.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that teaching them, if they don't have a specific African origin, like if they don't come from like Liberia or like Ghana or something, they don't have a specific piece. There are morals and there are African rituals and things that are all around. There are things that you can take from the African culture and, as a whole, and apply it to their lives that will constantly remind them that they are more than just black. They have some type of background or some type of depth that they can come from that will make them feel like they have some sort of identity. So just sharing music and culture and food and background information on just Africa in general and how they've helped us, how America has adapted things from African culture to form the culture that they call theirs today, I think teaching that to them on the daily basis will help them understand who they are as individuals and who they are as African Americans.
You're hearing the wise words of Kaya Hines. She's an activist from outside Milwaukee, 16-year-old junior at Franklin High School. We also have on the line Alicia Moten and Demetrius Doward. They'll be with us back after the break. We hope you stick around with us, too. We're discussing racism in America today, microaggressions and major violence, and the added tension of growing up and simply living while black. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing in our young activist stories? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking to three young African-American activists about life in their communities. We're inspired by the release, at least broadly today, of the film The Hate U Give. But our conversation is expanding to so much more. You can join our conversation. What are you hearing from these students? How do their accounts affect the way you think about race in the U.S.? What are your experiences? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Still with us from Chicago is Alicia Moten, a member and organizer with Good Kids Mad City. Kaya Hines, she's program coordinator at Leaders Igniting Transformation Milwaukee. And Demetrius Doward, a member of Million Hoodies Movement for Justice. I first wanted, though, to take a call from Tampa, Florida. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. First of all, hello and thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I give credit and praise to the youth for doing what they're doing. But I'm a 58-year-old black man, and this is nothing new in America, and I don't think it'll ever change. Matter of fact, it seemed like it got worse since the 70s, to be honest with you.
What's gotten worse, Michael?
The racial profiling and the tension between the races. I mean, look, we got Donald Trump elected. That's the attitude and the mentality of where the state of mind is. You know, the police force was created to keep the Jim Crow laws in check and everything. And that mentality and psychological profile is still on the police force today.
Thank you so much for your perspective, Michael. I appreciate it very much. Demetrius Doward, you focus a lot in your group, as I understand it, on thinking about how to de-escalate tensions with police. There's a line in the movie where Star Carter's uncle, who's on the police force, basically he's in her corner, but at a certain point he says to her, you know, police face a lot of dangerous circumstances, situations. You've got to understand that. How do you approach thinking about how you deal with police in this day and age and the challenges they face as well as the challenges that you might face?
I think it's respect. We need to respect for both sides. When I was 13, I had a experience with stop and frisk, and that pit me like to have a lot of fear. In the next 2 years, I always had like fear for police.
Can you tell me a bit about, Demetrius, can you tell me a little bit about what that incident was like?
Oh, it was like...
What happened?
It was scary. I was walking around my block And I was going building to building, trying to find a friend. And I know, like, these two policemen were following me. Mm-hmm. So I started, like, kind of walking fast because that was kind of scary. And they caught me around the corner, and they started to check my ankle to see if I had drugs or anything. And I had $20 because my pants didn't have no pockets. And I was just shaking the whole time. And they said, why are you scared? And I was like, this never happened to me before. So the next 2 years, every time a cop would, like, cruise by me, I would just, like, shake up. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it. You know, look, I live in New York and have for a while, and it's been part of the background of New York is that this debate on a policy level, you know, among people who make policies and laws about stop and frisk, you know, is about this issue. But it kind of takes it away from the human element, right? Like this affected not only your night, but how you thought about yourself out in public.
Yes. And I think I have a solution for that.
Uh-huh.
I think there should be like police officers in the same neighborhood for like years so we could start growing relationships with them and just not have every new police officer every like month or week. Like we should start growing relationships because I noticed one police officer and he has the same idea and we're like, we've been having conversations sometimes and I think that should happen. They should place police officers in the same neighborhood.
And there have been efforts to do that, but it sounds as though it hasn't, you know, taken root in a way that's been meaningful for you and your neighborhood, Demetrius.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, there was an exclusive interview today that Good Morning America had with Jeremiah Harvey. He's a 9-year-old mm-hmm. who was falsely accused of sexual assault, I believe in Brooklyn, New York, when his backpack brushed up against a woman in a corner store. The woman, Teresa Klein, is white. She called the police and has since apologized. But Jeremiah and his mother told Good Morning America that like Demetrius, they can't shake the incident.
It's still hard because I have this lately on my mind, like, I can't think nothing more but this. I felt humiliated.
Are you concerned that this has permanently scarred Jeremiah?
Yes, I certainly am.
It was devastating for him because even after walking away, he was pointing to, you know, patrol cars on Flatbush Avenue and saying, Mommy, are they here to take you away from us?
Kaya Hines, how much is this idea of living while black? We've heard instances where a man was stopped from entering his own home or his apartment building in St. Louis because a white resident there didn't trust him, although he lived there as well. How much does this affect kind of your daily rhythms of your life?
I think it affects me heavily because it creates this constant fear that you walk around and you carry. It creates when you drive, you look out of your rearview mirror, you see a police officer, and even though you're doing everything right, you immediately think, what am I doing wrong? And just to add on, listening to the video and the incident with the little boy, it very much reminded me of the situation with Emmett Till and how that affected him. Emmett Till had no idea what he had done wrong, and neither did the little boy that it just happened to. And they now, he feels as if he did something wrong. He feels as if he made a mistake or that, you know, something bad is going to happen to him at such a young age, and now he's going to grow up and have that carrying around on him. So just growing up black and living in this type of situation creates a constant amount of fear on you and a constant amount of worry and anxiety that you have to carry around because you just never know what is going to happen or what a small move is going to how that small move is going to affect you, affect your life in the long run. So
in the movie The Hate U Give, Star Carter, as I said earlier, played by Amanda Sternberg, is attends a mostly white school called Williamson Prep. After her friend Khalil is killed in a traffic stop by a police officer, some students take the opportunity to ditch school and to go to a protest. In this clip that we'll hear, Star rebukes her friend Haley, who's played by Sabrina Carpenter.
I just don't think it's, you know, cool to use the situation as an excuse to skip class.
What the hell, Star? It's not just an excuse to skip class. It's a good cause. It also happens to be a really good excuse to cut school. I really don't want to see our math teacher's face today, do you?
Kai, your school had what you guys call a book talk on The Hate U Give. What kinds of conversations did it prompt with your white classmates? Did it spark any new thoughts?
Actually, I had two of them, one my freshman year and then one maybe last week. Mm-hmm. The first one that I had with my freshman class actually did spark a conversation about what happened, but it wasn't a growing conversation. It was more so like my teacher talking and then people just kind of like wanting the conversation to be over. And then the one that I recently had last week was kind of the same thing. So none of them really sparked the major conversations based on what my teacher said and my classmates responding. It just kind of made it awkward for me on my end because I noticed that as she was reading the book and talking about the situation, everybody was kind of looking at me because I'm the only black student in the class. And in my school, I'm known for talking about activism and police brutality. So it just kind of, both times kind of gave, everyone kind of gave me the side eye. It didn't really bring up any heavy conversations, so.
So, Kaya, what hopes do you have for the movie in that case?
I really hope that after watching the movie, people understand the frustration that we have because there's a lot of people in my school and a lot of people that I know in general who I have a best friend, and she is really big on activism as well. And people look at us and they tell us that we are being overdramatic, that police officers are good, that the person who was shot and killed shouldn't have done whatever they did, that people now justify as a reason to die. People tell us that we're being overdramatic or that we're overthinking it or we need to let it go. But I really hope that after seeing this movie and actually seeing this happen and seeing the aftermath of the situation, not only on Star but on her community, I hope that seeing that will allow them to understand exactly how we feel. And I want them to be able to stop being closed-minded and honestly being ignorant. I hope that watching the movie allows them to be able to stand up and kind of fight against the problem with us.
Mm-hmm. Kaya, I also believe I read about a couple of incidents that had happened at your school that had, you could call them have racial overtones, but really kind of seemed kind of racist.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you deal with those?
Well, the biggest one that we've had that has circulated a lot was the water bubbler incident. And actually, when it happened, my best friend and I had went on vacation to Cancun.
And could you, forgive me, but tell listeners what actually happened.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we found out that when we left, we found out that there was water bubblers with one sign saying colored. I mean, one sign saying white only. And then there was an empty space next to the water bubbler that said colored. And a student had put those up during passing period, and other students found out. So while we were away, obviously we couldn't do anything. So we had our sister post the picture of the water bubblers on Facebook, and the photo winded up circulating, and news outlets contacted us. I remember it being in, like, Miami, and people were talking about it. So the person who put up the bubblers, I'm actually not sure what happened to them, but I just know that it sparked up a big conversation in our school of what actually happened and how it made us feel.
Got it. Thank you for that, Kaya. We also have a call at the moment from Three Lakes, Wisconsin. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I realize that I acknowledge that there are a ton of external, external negative things going on. I just wonder if at some point, or I guess I wonder if any of the guests would acknowledge some of the internal problems in the community that I guess basically, kind of like assist in the continuation of some of these problems. And again, I'd like to just add, I was spent 34 years in Milwaukee, so I'm not completely out of the situation. So.
Okay, well, thank you for John. Alicia, all three of you guys actually are involved very much in organizations that are working to sort of find productive solutions. Alicia, tell me a little bit about ways that you think are constructive paths that you and some of your colleagues in your group have tried to find.
One of the main issues that we really work on is arts and restorative justice. I feel like it's important that a lot of black and brown youth get the chance to express themselves through a creative way. Most of the people in our organization are artists in some form, so the things that we go through, the way that we get to like relieve our pain is by writing or singing or dancing or acting. And I think that to go back to the point of what was just said about things that we internalize, I think one of the things that we don't get a chance to experience is to let go of some of the grief that we have, because it's just a common thing that we just have to kind of just keep our head up and keep going in life. Mm-hmm. And I think most Black people live and they're just always in motion. It's like we don't really get a chance to be like, wow, I just lost somebody to gun violence. Let me grieve. It's like my cousin got shot. 2 weeks later, my best friend gets shot. 3 weeks later, this person dies, and then this person dies, and then this person dies. And it's like, when do we ever get the chance to really sit down and be able to take a breath? So I think the amount of grief that we go through that was either passed down to us through things that were never really solved, or just things that are happening like currently in time, and how it's a very uncommon thing for us to get help for this. To go back to when one of the previous callers were talking about the idea of mental health in most Black communities and how it's pretty much non-existent, and it's a stigma of being weak, and we're known to not be weak. And so when we show a sign of depression or anxiety or anything like that, we're not viewed as like the strong people that we are. But if you think about all the stuff that we've gone through, I think we have a chance to kind of be weak every once in a while, but we don't get that chance to do that. And so we just really try to like amplify wanting to express yourself, and it's okay to cry. It's okay to take days off. It's okay to do this. And we just really want to add in art and give Black people the chance to experience that, because they're in most like inner cities and most areas and neighborhoods where it's mostly Black populated. There's not like art centers. It's not community centers where you can go and write and do this and that. So it's very hard for us to have a release, because most people who live in like South or West Sides of Chicago, all we have is the streets or gangs, or our schools are being shut down. And if we don't have anything else to go to, where do you think that these people who now don't have a school, they're going to end up on the street, because there's no other outlet, because we're not being funded and we're not giving this opportunity to be something. And so I think that we are really just working to make sure that we always have something to rely on to give like expression, to be able to let go of the pain that we go through all the time.
Demetrius, as we close out this important hour, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope?
Yes, sir.
That's a good question. A lot of things. Just us as teenagers and how we're growing, and with social media, it's like easier to connect and like have a community. So that gives me hope. And a lot of kids my age are becoming aware, and that's great. That's great to see. Like, I'll be having conversations with my friends, and we just talk about like how we can uplift the community, and we're just trying to find solutions. So that gives me hope.
Tell me about a couple of the activities that you see friends doing that sort of lift them in their ways.
It's just like playing sports. We always, I remember my friend always throw like the Black Lives Matter t-shirt on, mm-hmm. like every time he like on the layup line, mm-hmm. and that's how we just started spreading the word, just with our fashion. That's how we spread the word.
Expression through fashion, expression through activity. It sounds like expression through activism in Chicago, trying to build bridges in Milwaukee. You've been hearing this hour some extraordinary voices about some extraordinarily powerful and important issues. Most recently, the voices of Demetrius Dougherty. He's a junior at Washington Heights Expeditionary Learning School and a member of Million Hoodies Movement for Justice. Demetrius, thanks you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave.
We've also been hearing from Alicia Moten. She's a senior at Kenwood Academy and a member and organizer with Good Kids Mad City. Thanks very much for all your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kaya Hines, she's a junior at Franklin High School, a program coordinator at Leaders Igniting Transformation Milwaukee. Such a pleasure to get to know you and to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue our conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.